Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, John Russell, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Indonesian President Joko Widodo gave control of 9 forests back to native or indigenous groups last December. The move was praised as an important step to recognize and protect forests traditionally held by indigenous Indonesians. However, indigenous groups were disappointed earlier this month when President Widodo did not attend a Congress of Indonesian Indigenous Groups. Instead, he sent Environment and Forestry Minister Siti Nurbaya. She said the recent release of land was, in her words, just the beginning. The Indigenous Peoples Alliance of the Archipelago, or AMAN, says an estimated 8.2 million hectares of forests belong to indigenous people. But the group says only 20,000 hectares of forest have been divested back to indigenous leaders by Indonesia. The newly elected Secretary General of AMAN did not blame the president, but those around him for slowing progress on the issue. In 2012, Indonesia's Constitutional Court ruled that indigenous forests should be protected. But it took more than 3 years after the ruling for President Widodo to sign over the first forests. There are other issues that have slowed the transfer of land to indigenous groups. These include wide geographical differences between areas to be protected and environmental threats. Adding to that are the many different traditional laws among the country's indigenous groups. Wimar Witolar worked with the Environment and Forest Ministry until 2015. He said, "This is the first time anything like this has been tried on Indonesian lands." He said the biggest part of the effort was to make a map of indigenous forests. Now that the maps are done, he says, transfers can go forward. Denis Rahadian is head of the Indonesian Community Mapping Network. Rahadian said getting district-level governments to supervise traditional village boundaries is important to speed forest transfers. For instance, it took 8 years to recognize that certain West Javanese forests belong to the Kesepuhan Banten Kidual people, said Rahadian. Environmental activist Aleta Baun said the goal is to have the government turn over all 8 million hectares to indigenous communities. She spoke at the meeting of indigenous groups. She said Jokowi's absence at the indigenous meeting this month hurt efforts to transfer forest lands. Kinarong Boy is an indigenous person from the island of Borneo. He says that a forest being designated as indigenous, does not protect it from farming or other activities. He says there are not yet any laws regulating the use of these traditional lands. We have customary land rights that are not yet encoded into laws, but we use our land for many things. That includes farming and caring for traditional relics and burial places, but these are not permitted by law. Moira Muliono is with the Center for International Forestry Research. She says the government has been slow to give forests to indigenous groups out of concern for how they will manage the forests. Yet the government management of forests was not much better, she said, adding that it was either use or conserve. However, indigenous control of forests does not mean that business activity stops. One group in South Sulawesi still permits logging in its forests in some areas. Tropical forests are of special interest because they can have an effect on the world's climate. A report from the World Resources Institute and Woods Hole Research Center in 2016 said tropical forests on indigenous lands are important for storing carbon. It said more than one quarter of all carbon held in tropical forests is on indigenous lands. Kinarongboi said indigenous people can deal with delays. We will wait for our forests to be protected, he said. We have held on to our lands this far, and we don't plan to sell them at any point in the future. I'm Mario Ritter.
What is more important to you when you read a news story on social media? The news agency or reporter who actually wrote the story, or the person who shares it? A new study has found that many Americans are more likely to believe information shared by someone they trust. The source of the information is not as important to them. In 2016, the Media Insight Project did a survey about trust and news on the social media service Facebook. It found that 2/3 of Facebook-using Americans said their trust in a news source had an important effect on their belief of the information. Only 48% said their trust in the person sharing a story had an important effect on how much they trusted that information. The Media Insight Project decided to set up an experiment to see if these findings were correct. The results of the experiment were different from those in the 2016 survey. The experiment found that a trusted sharer has more of an effect than a reputable media source. In other words, people were more likely to believe news shared by someone they trusted. Many of those questioned did not even remember the source after seeing a Facebook-style post. If there's somebody I like and agree with, they can have a big influence not only in what I look at, but in whether I believe it or not. I trust them, and I convey that trust to the news that they share, said Tom Rosensteel, executive director of the American Press Institute. Survey organizers write that people make little distinction between known and unknown, even made-up sources, when it comes to trusting and sharing news. The writers say the findings are important for members of the news media, news literacy activists, and social media networks. There has been a lot of talk recently about fake news, misinformation spread through social media and news media organizations. Facebook is now taking steps to call attention to fake news stories. It's important we give people the tools to make smart decisions about content, said Justin Osofsky, Facebook's Vice President of Global Operations and Media Partnerships. Critics have suggested that Facebook's decision to identify stories as false, instead of removing them from its website, shows the service is not doing enough. The project's findings show that news organizations should pay attention to how stories spread through social media. They might even want to consider sharing news by competitors in the hope they will do the same, said Rosenstiel. Readers are not just your audience anymore, he said. They're your ambassadors. I'm John Russell.
Ten years ago, scientists started noticing very brief but powerful radio bursts coming from outer space. Called fast radio bursts, or FRBs, they have been identified as millisecond-long bursts of radio emission. Scientists believe these emissions were made in a group of stars billions of light years away from Earth. A new theory says the radio bursts may be evidence of highly developed alien life. A paper describing the theory was published this month in the astrophysical journal Letters. The bursts cannot be seen with the human eye, but were observed by very large radio telescopes. Many scientists believe that these powerful flashes may be related to the collapse of a massive star. But scientist Avi Loeb says researchers have yet to confirm any natural cause of the emissions. Loeb is chair of Harvard University's astronomy department and works at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He believes the bursts might be coming from powerful equipment like a transmitter used on Earth to broadcast radio or television signals. He thinks the device could be as big as a planet and have enough power to send large spaceships great distances. While noting this is just speculation, Loeb told VOA what he suspects might be producing the fast radio bursts. Loeb says it could be created by alien life forms belonging to a highly developed civilization. He thinks the powerful bursts could be a sign of leakage when light hitting the sail moves just past the edge of the sail. It shows up on Earth as a very bright, fast-moving radio wave.
And the idea is that the beam of light that is being used to push the sail is leaking. We see leakage of that radiation. And if the beam is powerful enough, we could see it from a great distance. And because the beam is sweeping across the sky, we would see it as a flash of light, as a burst of radio waves, the way these fast radio bursts appear.
If there are aliens, life outside our planet, are they a threat? Loeb does not think so. If they do exist, they are great distances from us, he notes. So there is no danger for us directly. The bursts were first observed in 2007. Since then, a total of 18 have been identified using very large radio telescopes. Some of the researchers have been at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in the American state of New Mexico. They identified where one burst came from, a dwarf galaxy more than 3 billion light years from Earth. Sarah Burke Spoloer teaches physics and astronomy at West Virginia University. She reported on the discovery earlier this year in two journals, Nature and Astrophysical Journal Letters. Burke Spoloer says the fast radio burst was first discovered in November of 2012 at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. The NRAO radio telescope later helped to identify where the FRB came from. What makes this emission different is that it is the only one to keep sending bursts, about 200 times so far. Burke Spoloer says there are many ideas about what FRBs are. She says the leading theory is that these are related to neutron stars in other galaxies. They could also come from black holes, areas with a gravitational field so intense that no matter or radiation can escape. She describes Avi Loeb as an out-of-the-box thinker. She says his theories have an important job. They make us reconsider our assumptions and what we know and don't know. She adds, it doesn't mean the theory is anywhere near right, but we don't have enough evidence to rule it out. And where did Loeb get the idea that the fast radio bursts come from light pushing a spaceship? Loeb leads a team developing technology to send spacecraft to a planet called Proxima B. The project is called Breakthrough Starshot. He and the team are developing thousands of small spacecraft with sails. They want to use laser beams to push those sails forward. That got him thinking.
The fact that we are starting to think about propelling a spacecraft with light made me think about the possible signals that we could detect from the sky from a civilization that is using this technology.
For now, Loeb's idea is just a theory. He and others say it will take more information to know if his theory is right. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about John Quincy Adams. Does his name sound familiar? John Quincy Adams, the sixth president, was the son of John Adams, the second president. Like his father, Quincy Adams had a sharp mind and a difficult personality. And, like his father, Quincy Adams served only one 4-year term as president. But Quincy Adams went on to have many successful years working in a different job. He is the only former president, so far, to serve in the House of Representatives. The parents of John Quincy Adams, John and Abigail, were strong patriots. Theirs was one of the founding families of the United States. Abigail Adams especially raised her son to serve his country. She expected him to become president. She told him that, with his good education and training, if he did not serve in a high public office, it would be his own fault. Quincy Adams did not disappoint his mother. As a child, he learned to speak at least 4 languages and read Greek and Latin. He also studied Shakespeare's plays. At age 10, he traveled with his father to Europe. As a young man, he worked alongside John Adams in American diplomatic offices in Paris, Amsterdam, and St. Petersburg. Finally, Quincy Adams returned to his home in Boston in time to graduate from Harvard. He was working as a lawyer by the age of 23. Stories confirm that Quincy Adams was a brilliant boy and young man, but he rarely compromised his ideas. His inability to work with other lawmakers and to consider public opinion were partly to blame for his difficult presidency. Quincy Adams may have been a poor politician, but he was an excellent diplomat. In the early part of his career, he served as the American ambassador to the Netherlands, Germany, Russia, and Britain. He helped lead the negotiations that ended the War of 1812, and he served for 8 years as Secretary of State under James Monroe. Some of that president's accomplishments owe a lot to Quincy Adams. He helped negotiate the purchase of Florida from Spain, and he was one of the people responsible for the Monroe Doctrine. It warned Europe not to interfere in the Western Hemisphere. But Quincy Adams could be impatient, especially with lawmakers. Many of them, he believed, did not care much about the country and wanted to help only themselves. Quincy Adams also avoided political battles. As Secretary of State, he appointed people whom he thought were capable, even if they did not support his political party. Similarly, when he became president, he tried to bring political opponents, along with representatives of different parts of the country, together in his cabinet. His opponents, however, refused to serve, and although his cabinet included Southerners, he did not really have the support of the South. Yet Quincy Adams talked about unity in his presidential inaugural speech. Adams said, "The Constitution and the representative democracy of the United States had proved a success. The nation was free and strong and stretched across the continent, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. He noted that political divisions had eased. So now, he said, it was time for the people to settle their differences and make a truly national government. In his first message to Congress, President Adams described his ideas. The chief purpose of the government, he said, was to improve the lives of the people it governed. To do this, he offered a national program of building roads and canals. He also proposed a national university and a national scientific center. Adams said Congress should not be limited to making laws only to improve the nation's economic life. He said it should make laws to improve the arts and sciences, too. But many people of the West and South did not believe that the Constitution gave the federal government the power to do all these things. They believed these powers belonged to the states. Their representatives in Congress rejected the president's proposals. In addition, a new opposition party was trying to weaken support for Quincy Adams. They supported a general from Tennessee named Andrew Jackson. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says, John Quincy Adams was never able to meet the high expectations many people had for him. His presidency was a complete failure, Unger told VOA. He was able to accomplish nothing. Quincy Adams lost the presidential election of 1828 in a landslide. He refused to attend the inauguration of Andrew Jackson. He returned to his home in Quincy, Massachusetts, depressed and worried about the country. His wife, Louisa Catherine Johnson Adams, believed they were returning to Massachusetts to stay. She was an American, but was born in England. Her mother was British. She was, at the time, the first foreign-born First Lady. John and Louisa had four children, but their only daughter had died as a baby. Their sons were grown by the time Quincy Adams retired from the presidency. Soon he became restless. Some neighbors asked if Quincy Adams would consider representing the district as a member of the U.S. Congress. He agreed, but only if voters would let him act as he believed was right, instead of as what would be politically popular. Apparently, they agreed, too, because voters elected Quincy Adams to the House of Representatives 9 times. In Congress, Quincy Adams often fought for citizens' individual liberty. He also strongly opposed slavery. His ideas were not wildly popular at the time, especially among other lawmakers. They had created a rule that said Congress would not even consider any measures against slavery. Yet Quincy Adams defended the rights of enslaved people, frequently and sometimes successfully. He died at the age of 88, a few days after suffering a stroke on the floor of the House of Representatives. At the time, lawmakers were considering a proposal, and, as usual, John Quincy Adams was loudly voting no. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.